coming to you from the secret vault where they keep all the bronze medals. Just the bronze ones, though. It's the Liberal Arts,
a podcast about postgraduate life and the things we would study if someone were paying us.
Please, somebody pay us.
Well, hi everyone. I'm Science.
I'm Cleo.
And I'm Rissa.
We should do a podcast now.
Mm-hmm.
We should. We should pod that cast and cast that pod.
Yeah.
Hey, you're casting a pod! How'd your casting a pod go? Sorry, this isn't part of the podcast. I just realized the pun worked really well for Hannah's whole auditions thing this morning.
I am casting a pod! It went real good.
Good.
We'll talk about that at length later.
Yeah, sorry. I just had to seize that pun while it was there.
I said at length.
Okay.
Yes, we'll all have lunch. Okay. Do you have a fun fact for us, Cleo?
I do. It's sort of a mini collection of fun facts. Of fun facts revolving around an upcoming holiday.
Labor Day.
So
Lent.
Mardi Gras. Memorial Day.
No.
President's Day.
No and no. So if you're
Easter.
Listening to this episode, stop it. Wasn't
Wednesday.
Lent last time and it's not Lent now. If you're listening to this episode on the day it comes out, it is Valentine's Day.
Also Ash Wednesday.
Oh.
It is also Ash Wednesday. So if you are one of those people who decided to give up chocolate for Lent, bad
Have
timing.
Fun.
Bad.
We're so sorry.
Bad timing. I have a collection of fun facts about February the 14th, but first of all, since Valentine's Day is the holiday of love, is there any creature in the natural world that you would think of? What sort of animal or creature comes to mind when you think of love and romance?
Swans mate for life.
Swans are good.
So
romantic
do turtle
love.
Doves. Sparrows do not, although everyone thought they did for a long time.
Yeah, there's
They're
a
actually
lot of type
dirty
of birds
philanderers.
That do. I want to say albatrosses do, but I could be wrong on that.
That is the least romantic bird I can think of, though.
You remember that part in the 12 Days of Christmas where it's like six flying albatross?
That's not one of the 12 Days of Christmas.
Here, dear, let's release an albatross at our wedding.
One of those weddings being performed with the captain of a ship in international waters, I'm sure.
It's going to become a really bad metaphor for an albatross around your neck, though.
It's got a massive wingspan.
Super bad.
The creature I have in question is the honeybee.
Oh, I thought you were going to say the honey badger for a second. Okay, honeybee. Honeybee's good.
Honeybees have, in the past, been associated with love and romance. So, apparently, they have the power to sniff out cheaters.
Yes!
So,
sure.
If you were a young medieval maiden and you're getting married to a fine medieval young man, you should march him past the family's beehives and see if he gets stung. If the
That's
bees
amazing.
Don't sting him, he will be faithful to you. If they do, you should...
It's really...
Yeah.
Go ahead.
Did you all ever watch Jupiter Rising?
No.
So. But still, I like the fact that they're totally chill, unless there's a cheater, in which case they're like, get him!
Apparently, you should also not swear around bees, because they will sting you. They're very moral creatures, but in parts of medieval Europe, there's a tradition called telling the bees, where beekeepers had a superstition that you had to inform the bees of any big events in your life, including deaths and weddings.
This is amazing.
This is a thing in Pratchett!
Yeah.
Oh my gosh, I love
this.
This
totally happens.
It's a thing that people really did in medieval Europe and also in parts of colonial America.
Which means probably still do somewhere, and I love it.
Probably somewhere, but so you had to tell the bees, or they would get really upset and swarm and maybe leave. And for weddings,
let's be real. If any animal on this planet secretly is an alien of super intelligence that came from elsewhere or in the ancient abstract time, it's definitely bees.
And one of the
my favorite part about that is, let's be real.
One of the ways you have to inform the bees about the wedding is that you decorate the hives with ribbons and leave them a piece of wedding cake.
I love that's that! So that's so good! This is going in my next D&D campaign.
Next time you want to go on a romantic date with that special someone, consider taking them to a beehive.
Just in case. What if they sting you? And then it's like, oh no, I am a cheater and I didn't even know it.
Well, then you should thank them for giving you a chance to reform your life.
Oh,
that's very true.
Maybe give up chocolate for Lent. I don't know. But the reason I discovered this about bees is because I was Googling someone else connected to Valentine's Day, namely the person it's named after, Saint Valentine, who is the patron saint of beekeeping.
Is that why?
Bless!
He's not the only patron saint of beekeeping, but he's one of them.
I think he's also one of the many, many patron saints of, like, curing the plague, so.
Yep. He is. So, Saint Valentine, who was beheaded for secretly marrying people after marriage had been outlawed under the Roman Emperor Claudius because he was convinced that marriage was the reason no one wanted to join the army.
Yeah, that's the reason. Good job, Claudius. Really
Saint Valentine,
perceptive there, buddy.
Saint Valentine has, since his martyrdom and decapitation, which is all very romantic, is it? Has since been recognized as the patron saint of love, lovers, engaged people, beekeeping, the plague, epilepsy, and fainting.
Oh, okay. Epilepsy and fainting, that's okay.
Smart. But he is not the only person to have an important event and a death happen to them on February 14th.
Who else died?
Well, the world was a little less sad about this, but on February 14th, 1929... 7 members of a Chicago gang were gunned down in a parking garage.
What?
By members of
the
Al
Valentine's
Capone's
Day Massacre.
Gang. Yes.
Yeah.
The St. Valentine's Day Massacre also happened on February 14th. And then two other interesting things that happened on February 14th were in 1876, February 14th, 1876, we have the birth date of Sakichi Toyota.
Oh, wow.
Of the Toyota, I imagine.
Of Toyota Automatic Loom Company.
Yes.
What?
Automatic looms were the basis of, like, all modern technology, I swear.
Yes.
Including computers.
That's, like, the most... That sentence, though, Rissa.
They were. Automatic looms were amazing, and they were... They're why we have computers.
They're pretty cool.
Holy crap.
So, his family went into the making of automatic looms and mechanical weaving devices. Apparently, he was known as the Japanese Thomas Edison. And in the late 1920s, his son opened a separate branch of the family company, the Toyota Motor Corporation.
Aha!
From where we get Toyota cars. And then, science, you're going to like this one. On February 14th, 1929, the world... was apprised of a grand new discovery / invention that would change the lives of millions. Penicillin.
Yes.
Yay!
So, yay.
My sister is deathly allergic to penicillin.
My mother is deathly allergic to penicillin.
Honestly, penicillin proper does not work for most people anymore because most bacteria has become immune to it.
Huh.
But we have lots of different antibiotics, and you should always take all of your antibiotics when they are prescribed to you so that you can help fight off antibiotic-resistant bacteria. This has been a PSA.
But only if they are prescribed to you. Also a
yes.
PSA.
Yeah, don't take antibiotics if you're not prescribed. Seriously. And don't take them for viruses. They don't work.
Yeah.
Anyway.
So yes, that is my random collection of fun facts about February the 14th.
I have learned so much.
Especially
and I'm
about bees.
To learn more.
I've actually spent way too much time researching bees. And I actually...
Hey, that is
I don't
not
think
time
that
wasted.
That sounds like too much time at all. Mm-mm. That's time
no,
well spent right
like,
there.
I have actually gotten someone to put me in contact with a beekeeper. I've been
That's
asking
amazing.
Him questions about beekeeping. Happy Valentine's Day. Happy Ash Wednesday.
Happy?
Is it happy? Do you wish people a happy Ash Wednesday?
I don't know.
Have a good Ash Wednesday.
Good yeah, Ash good. Wednesday.
Have a repentant Ash Wednesday.
Peace be with you. I don't know what the proper greeting for
and
Ash Wednesday is.
And also with you. We're not Catholic enough for
and
this.
And with your spirit.
Hey, Rissa, do you have a colloquium for us?
Yeah, but before we get to the colloquium, we've got a quick message from some of our podcast friends.
Hi, I'm Jacob Wilson.
And I'm Taylor Wilson.
And we're the hosts of a new podcast called Good Taste.
Basically, we like to talk about stuff that we like.
So this can be everything from TV, music, and movies to sports, apps, and food. Taylor, what are some things you talked about last time?
Yeah, last week I talked about U.S. soccer failing and a podcast about cults.
And I talked about one of my favorite Twitter accounts and a new Broadway musical called The Band's Visit. We basically just offer up a couple of recommendations on a bi-weekly basis.
Yeah, and we also want to hear what listeners suggest for us to look into, and we're going to go over the hottest news in pop culture.
If you want to be the coolest person at your office, you got to listen to this.
Comes out every other Friday, wherever you get your podcasts.
Get Good Taste now.
Wow, what a great message.
No, but it's exciting to be connected to more podcasts. The podcast community is awesome, and it's great to be kind of becoming more a part of it.
Yes.
Yeah, thanks, guys. And thank you for hosting our promo on your show.
Okay, so now, before we get to this colloquium, I've got a few caveats that I don't normally have to give.
You always have caveats.
I know,
but these
are like... If
we're not spending the first 10 minutes of our colloquium defining terms, then we're not doing it right.
Oh, this entire colloquium is defining terms. I'm not kidding. Which is...
All right, here we go.
90% of philosophy, so...
Let me resituate.
But no, but for real, I've got some caveats. So, so the idea that we had when we started a lot of this was that, this being the podcast, was that all academics kind of need side projects. Thing you genuinely enjoy studying, but you don't want to do formal academic work on. Things that are outside of your field, or things that you think doing formal work on would just kind of ruin your love for them. I've had several topics like that. Cleo, have you done or submitted any, like, formal academic work on the history of Turkey?
No.
Okay, so this is going to be the first time that we're going to share any of our actual formal research, because my next three colloquiums are going to be a presentation of my master's thesis, which, because this is a philosophy thesis, means mostly original thought from me. I'm currently working on editing it into three sections to be sent out for publication. So I thought it'd be a great time to do a colloquium, but I haven't ever presented any of these in conference, so this is basically the first time any of this has been shared outside of Oxford. And when
it's
I say shared outside of
look.
Oxford, like, we even within Oxford, the only way that's been shared is that I sent a copy to the library for them to put deep in the vaults of wherever they keep everyone's theses.
Next to the bronze medals.
Yeah, sure. So yeah, like I said, this, basically, this is my stuff, and I don't normally have to say this, but, you know, like, TM, 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 or whatever, but for real this time, I feel like I don't really have to ask because of who our audience is, but please don't steal my stuff.
I mean, even if they did, you're, like, in the Oxford
I know,
library
but
now.
It's, it
People,
is weird
we'd find
to...
you, and we'd kill you. No.
Yeah. It's just, it's weird for me to be presenting this in such an informal manner before I'm able to present it formally in any way.
Okay.
But I did want to share it with you guys. But yeah, the second part of that was just, if you want more information or to read my thesis, please message us or message me, but I will not be posting a public link for you to read it. If I get any of it published, I will definitely post links then, but I'm not just going to post this somewhere, okay?
Sounds good.
There's my caveats. Done. So I tell people that my thesis is about video games, and it is about video games, but it's actually more about...
But I tell other people's people that my thesis is a secret.
I tell everyone that I wrote my thesis on video games, and I did, but I really wrote my thesis on fictional truth. So I guess I want to start by explaining what fictional truth is. What do you guys think it is? It sounds kind of oxymoronic. Fictional truth.
Canon?
No, but canon is a good... Canon's a great, great guess there. Well, not guess. Bleh, a great summation, really. And canon is something I would certainly like to study more. If I ever do a doctorate, I might do it on the idea of canon, but... Yeah, fictional truths are just those things which are true in a story. And exactly how those relate to real things, like real truths, is debatable. And I'm not going to get into that. I did not write about fictional realism. But, for instance, it's fictionally true that Sherlock Holmes lives at 221B Baker Street. We all know that, right?
Yes.
Yes.
But here's the thing. He doesn't, though. Right? Like, he doesn't. I've been to 221B Baker Street, and nobody lives there. Nobody by the name of Sherlock Holmes has ever lived at 221B Baker Street. But everyone knows that that's where Sherlock lives. He doesn't live at 222B Baker Street. He lives at 221B Baker Street. That's a fictional truth.
Right.
And there can be fictional falsehoods. If I said, Darth Vader is not Luke Skywalker's father, it's like, no, that's wrong. Not just those people don't exist, but no, that is incorrect, fictionally. So I'm not gonna get into a huge definition of, like, what makes things fictionally true just yet, but these are pretty standard. There are some more complex forms of fictional truth. For example, one of the questions that gets tossed around in the literature is things like, does Sherlock Holmes have a liver? What? It's never explicitly said that he does.
I mean, he takes enough drugs that he'd have to.
Yeah. Well, it's never, like, explicitly said he has a liver, but as we all know, he's a human being, and human beings have livers, so we should probably assume he has one.
we can make that safe extrapolation.
And this is just a pretty silly example, but there's a lot of extrapolation that you do when you read stories. There's a lot of stuff that authors don't have to say, and a lot of times authors really play with that space. Sometimes they subvert things by suddenly telling you that you were wrong by assuming that this person had a liver or whatever, that kind of thing. And sometimes things are even the opposite of what the narrator says, especially if you have an unreliable narrator, and the audience is supposed to understand that the things which are being said and the things which are fictionally true don't always line up. So that's kind of the big debate in talking about fictionally true. And you can talk about that with lots of forms of media. But the question I want to ask about fictional truth is specific to video games. And it's not about what happens when what's true and what's told is different. It's what happens when what's true is different every time you encounter a work. So the example question that I use in my paper is, in the game Mass Effect, is Commander Shepard female? Now, normally the gender of the main character of a work of fiction is pretty easy to establish. But with Mass Effect, Shepard can be female or male. If I play Mass Effect, I can answer that question with yes or no. I get to pick, but it's one way or the other. Every time I play Mass Effect, it's either yes or no. It's not both, it's not maybe, it's anything like that. It is yes or no.
Okay.
So how do we answer this question? In Mass Effect, is Commander Shepard female? The key here is that I asked in Mass Effect, in the game itself, which turns out to be different from when I play Mass Effect. So to explain this more, I'm going to have to start getting kind of technical. Fictional truths belong to works. Works is one of the key terms I'm going to be using here. And the first step to figuring out what's fictionally true in a video game is figuring out what exactly the work is that bears fictional content. So my understanding of what a work is highly indebted to Kendall Walton's theory of make-believe, which is something I'm going to talk a lot more about in my next colloquium. Basically, he thinks that works are things which inspire and mandate they're appreciators to make believe certain things. So when you see the Mona Lisa, you are make believing that you see a woman. You don't really see a woman, you see paint. But the paint mandates that if you want to appreciate this work, you are going to make believe that it's a woman, right? Mm-hmm. That's the basics of this theory.
Okay, so it's the reversal of the whole this is not a pipe argument.
Yeah, it's a lot like that. But it works for more than just visual art as well. If I read The Hobbit, I am going to make believe that, you know, that hobbits do things and stuff.
Hobbits exist and do things.
Yeah, exactly. I'm going to make believe that, and I'm not going to bring all these objections about the real world or that didn't happen into play. I'm not going to call Tolkien a liar for saying that there once was a hobbit, you know?
You could, but you'd end up a joke on the internet.
Yeah. So normally it's pretty easy to point out what works of art are. Paintings are, you know, that's the work. But there are types of work that can be what's called multiple, meaning that they can be instance many times. So the relationships between works and their instances can be different depending on the medium. For example, Pride and Prejudice is not a book. It's a work. Books have pages and ink. Works don't. Pride and Prejudice is a story. It has words in, but it doesn't have pages. So Pride and Prejudice is instanced every time a new book is printed.
Okay. Following? And some of the instances are identical.
Yeah.
But they're still individual.
Yes. But even if you destroyed every single copy of Pride and Prejudice ever printed, you wouldn't really have destroyed Pride and Prejudice, which is a work.
Right, because there are certain friends of ours, Shannon, who would never, ever forget, ever.
Yeah, sure. Films are instanced every time they're played. So films get even more complex because not only can you make multiple copies of a film strip or DVD or whatever, it's not really the DVD that's the film, is it? It's what happens when you play the DVD on a DVD player and it's put on a screen and you watch it. That's a film. Games take a little bit more than this. That's a process known as decoding. When you have to decode a work, that means you have to use a machine or something to make instance the work by, say, playing a film.
Games. So you technically have to decode books, too, because you have to read them, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I guess so.
Or, like, you can even take that farther, like, a six-month-old can't experience a work if audibly because they don't have the mental skills to decode language yet.
I don't really want to throw around these terms super lightly because they're not my terms when it comes to things like decoding. I think you're on the right track. I don't want to confirm that you're right because I might be wrong there.
Okay, I'll take it.
Okay. I would say it's more like decoding if you want to read Homer, you need to decode it first because you don't know ancient Greek.
Well, I wouldn't be one decoding it. It'd be someone else.
I know. Decoding is almost always done by someone else or something else. It's usually done by a machine. But we'll get to this in a bit. I want to talk about games first.
Okay.
Because games, the problem with games is if you decode it through a machine, that means you put the game, say, into a console and push the play button. Not much happens. It might play an intro sequence, but then the game is just going to sit there. It's going to wait for you. You have to play the game in order to generate anything. You need the game and the machine and a player. You can push play on a film and then walk away, and the playing film will still be instanced, even if no one's watching it. But a game needs a player. It needs an audience to shape what's happening. And so what I argue is that when you do this, you instance the game by generating what I call a playthrough. Now, playthrough is a term I made up. I think it's a work in the Waltonian sense. It's the audiovisual representation, which bears fictional content, that's generated when a player plays a game.
To be fair, you didn't invent the word playthrough. You're just the first one to apply it philosophically, right?
Coining the term. Okay. It's basically.
Okay. All right. I'm with you.
Yeah. Basically, people have referred to this in philosophy before, but there's never been a standard term for this. So a big part of what philosophy is establishing the philosophy, establishing the vocabulary. vocabulary is extremely important to philosophy because it's the framework by which we can have these discussions. So the fact that playthroughs exist and we can point to them and give them a name is important. Does that make sense?
Yes.
Yeah. So this whole colloquium is going to be about, like I said, defining terms, establishing new vocabulary. And that's really what I'm trying to do with it. But here's the catch. Every time you print a book, it's hopefully exactly the same as all the other books. And every time you watch a film, exactly the same thing happens in fiction. Darth Vader is always going to be Luke Skywalker's father every single time.
No.
But when you play a game, it's going to be different every time you play it. So what's true when I play Mass Effect is different than what's true when my sister plays Mass Effect, or even if I play it a second time. When I play Mass Effect, Shepard is a woman, but when my sister plays, Shepard is a man. So you can see how it's really hard to ask what's true in Mass Effect.
Yeah.
But we can say what's true in the instance, in the playthrough of Mass Effect. And I want to say we can do a little bit of both. That's the central question of Chapter 1, is basically how do we address all the different conflicting fictional truths presented by the multiple playthroughs of a video game and still address games as works, like we address films and literature, and not just a collection of little bitty works, but actually instances of the same work, basically. Because it makes sense for us to address them as instances of the same work, you know? But philosophically, that's kind of hard to do. So my solution is actually to compare games to not films, which most people compare them to, but to theater, to stage plays.
That makes a lot more
sense. Yeah, theater does a lot of stuff similarly. So there's this overarching work, the play, and plays are instanced by performances. So there are certain things that are true in the work. It's fictionally true that Hamlet says to be or not to be. Always. That's in Hamlet itself, the play. But every time a play is performed, it's performed a little bit differently. There are different productions and different performances, and each of them has different fictional truths which aren't true in the work itself, Hamlet, but are true in that specific performance. So, like, Hamlet is always going to say to be or not to be, but Hamlet isn't always going to be, say, brunette, you know? He doesn't have to be brunette, but in this one, it's fictionally true that he is.
Right.
So there's two kind of levels of fictional truth that you encounter every time you encounter a performance. So when you watch a performance, there's two levels of truth going on there, and you can't always tell which one is which. And I argue that games do the exact same thing. There are some things which are true in the game itself, and some things which are only true in certain playthroughs, and not in other playthroughs.
So in our portrayal of the Tempest, it was fictionally true that we used all the lines, but fictionally true in that instance that all the characters had space phones.
Okay.
I don't know why you hate our very good 2-week prep performance of the Tempest.
Oh, I think
it was I would a say coconut more, Caliban.
I think it was beautiful.
So the lines, as lines, don't really exist in fiction. I would say that it is both fictionally true in your performance of The Tempest that a prince crashes onto the island in a storm, which is also true in The Tempest, and it is also fictionally true in your performance of The Tempest that everyone has space phones, which is not part of The Tempest, to the play. So those are the two
Shakespeare
levels.
Shakespeare was so ahead of his time.
Yes.
And a lot of times with plays, it's pretty easy to tell which ones are true of the play itself, because plays have scripts, for the most part. And you can encounter a play in a different way than it being instanced in a performance. You can read the play.
Mm-hmm.
That's not something you can do most of the time with games. But before I get into that, I want to just once again establish some vocabulary. So these two levels of truths, I'm going to refer to them as video game truths, that's things that are true in the video game itself, and playthrough truths, which are only true in this playthrough and not in the play itself. Just, I'm going to use those later, and I wanted to establish them, because that's how philosophy works. So it's just a lot harder to check whether something is true in the video game itself, because there's not a script. The only way you can encounter things that are fictionally true in video games is by encountering them in playthroughs. And then they look exactly like the things that are playthrough specific, like playthrough truths, right? One thing you could do is play the game a lot and compare a ton of different playthroughs and see which things change and which things stay the same. And that's not completely reliable, because it could be a lot of coincidence. You'd have to compare every possible playthrough of the game for this to work.
Is this what you actually did for your master's thesis research?
No, it's not. I swear. I still can't complete a renegade run-through of Mass Effect. Are you kidding? No, but that's not the real problem here. Even if you had time and that is the project you wanted to do, you have to define what counts as a playthrough. See, games are what I call variable in scope. One of the weird things about video games that's not really true in most other works of fiction is that they can include content which is available but not forced on the player. It'd be like if you wrote a book and put a note in saying, you can skip this chapter if you want. So there's a lot of stuff that if you want to see and do everything in a game, you can, or you can just skip bits. This isn't true in every single game, but it's true in lots of them. So the problem is this. If we're going to say that video game truths are true in every playthrough, then we need to be really careful with how we define a playthrough, or be careful at least with how we define what it means for something to be true in a playthrough. So the example I use is this. In the game Dragon Age Origins, there's this character, Alistair, who has a sister. And you only learn about her in a side quest, which you could skip to finish the game without ever encountering her. So I say, imagine I play Dragon Age Origins twice. The first time... Imagine I played Dragon Age Origins twice. The first time, I rush through the entire game. I skip all the side quests. I just want to finish the game and see how the story ends. Second time, I take my time, I do every side quest, I see everything this game has to offer, which, by the way, would take ages, because that game is super long. In my first playthrough, I never encounter Alistair's sister. I probably don't even know she exists, because I didn't spend enough time talking to Alistair. Whereas in the second playthrough, obviously, I meet her. In the first playthrough of Dragon Age Origins, does Alistair have a sister?
Potentially?
See, this is the problem. Potentially is a great way to say it. Does she, though? It's never implied, it's never described. But I want to say that she does, and the reason for that is this. If we say, no, only things that are explicitly told to or possibly implied to the player are part of the fictional truth that makes up that playthrough, then now we really have to define what a playthrough is. Because what if I turned on the game and played for 1 minute and then turned the game off and never played again? Is that a playthrough? Especially for games that don't have proper endings. Yeah, but there's a lot of games that don't have super proper endings. Like games with open worlds that maybe don't have strict plot lines. That could be legit, you know? Think of Minecraft. Is there such thing as a playthrough of Minecraft? There's not, like, a plot with a beginning and a middle and an end. It's just a world. Mm. You're just in it. So things like that. But if we could say that there are things which are never described to the player in any way, explicit or implicit, which are still true in a playthrough, even if the player never ever encounters them, because they were available to the player, whether or not they were ever encountered, that kind of makes this problem go away. Because if I turn on a game and play for 1 minute and leave, then there's a lot of stuff that was available to me, but just not encountered, that we can still say is true. Now, the reason it's important to me that it's true even in that 1 minute playthrough is because I've said that the only things true in video games themselves are true in every single playthrough, right? So right. I want to make it rather broad what's true in a video game by saying that it's true in every playthrough, but it might not be shown to the player in every single playthrough. So
well, then you've got contradictions, though.
Which contradictions? Please don't do this. Like, this is my master's thesis.
No, I mean, like, okay, so if it's all true, if it's a choice, then there are things that are simultaneously true.
No. See, this like, is the thing. You haven't let me actually define what's true yet.
Okay, go ahead. Cool.
So the conclusion I come to is that if something is true, fictionally true, in at least one possible playthrough, and never contradicted in any other possible playthrough, then it's a video game truth. It's true in the video game itself. But if something's true in at least one possible playthrough, and ever contradicted in any other possible playthrough, then it's a playthrough truth. It's not true in the video game itself. Just the playthrough.
I'm with you. Cool. I'm back on it.
Yeah, so things like Lara Croft is British, or Alistair has a sister, or Commander Shepard is human. Those are video game truths. They're true in the playthrough, even in playthroughs in which they're not made explicit or even implied to the player, like Alistair having a sister. They're never contradicted. They're true in at least one, never contradicted in any other. But then things like Shepard is female, that is contradicted in a lot of playthroughs of Mass Effect. But because it's contradicted in even one possible playthrough, it's not a video game truth. It's not true in the game itself. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So those are the two terms that I really, the three terms that I really try to set up with this first chapter. Playthroughs, playthrough truths, and video game truths. I have this whole other section about what I call fictionally true disjunctives, about how we could say that the full phrase Commander Shepard is either female or not female is true in the video game itself, but I think we're just going to skip that bit, because just for time, it's a rather long side note, and it's actually going to probably be edited out of the part that I publish anyway, so...
Oh, there you go.
Let's just recap some terms. This has all been about setting up terms, right? So yes, works are things which inspire people or mandate people to make believe. Works are things like Pride and Prejudice, Star Wars, Hamlet, Mass Effect, that kind of thing. Those are works. Instances are how we encounter these works. So a copy of Pride and Prejudice, a screening of Star Wars, a performance of Hamlet, and a playthrough of Mass Effect. With plays and video games, works and performances are both sources of fictional truth, and they don't always contain the same fictional truths, unlike with books and films and things, in which case they generally contain the same fictional truths between their works and instances. But with games and theater, works and instances are both sources of fictional truth, and the instances are broader, are less narrow in what they contain. So instances contain all of the works' fictional truths plus some, right? And for games, it can be really hard to determine which type of fictional truth you're looking at when you look at one. The definition I give is that if anything is fictionally true in at least one possible playthrough of a video game and never contradicted any other possible playthrough of that video game, then it's a video game truth. Otherwise, it's a playthrough truth. Right. So, those are my terms. That's what this whole colloquium was just defining the terms. Next time, I'm going to talk about Chapter 2, in which I address why what I've just said could be controversial, because it might actually contradict Walton's theory of make-believe, which is what inspired it in the first place.
Oh, that'll be fun.
Okay.
Yeah, so when I was writing this, it started out as a me writing in support of Walton, and then I slowly realized that what I was saying directly contradicted what Walton said, and it took a lot of convincing on my supervisor's part that that was okay, and that I could just say that he's wrong.
That is one thing I envy about philosophy, is that you can just make up words. It's a lot harder to just make up words in my
papers.
Well,
the problem with that is that most of the time we don't make up words. We take words and give them really specific definitions, even though in English or whatever language, they're used far more broadly. So there's a couple terms that I actually have trouble using nowadays because I have far too specific a definition for them. Like the other day someone used the word magnanimous and they meant it to be good. Benevolent, I think, is the word that is most fitting there. But to me, magnanimous means a really specific thing in Aristotelian philosophy. So it was kind of like, sorry, can you, and it's not, it wasn't like, I don't know the word magnanimous. It was like, what do you mean by using the word magnanimous? Because I think it's different than what I mean by using the word magnanimous.
I mean, things,
so things
the...
like in epistemology, if you use the word know as in knowledge,
it's a justified
true people
belief.
Are like, I'm sorry, you can't use that word. We need to define the hell out of that word. The whole conversation of epistemology is just defining that word.
I just, the closest thing I get to this is that from the philosophy class we took together in undergrad, I cannot use the term platonic love anymore.
No, yeah.
People are like, I just love him platonically, and I'm like,
yeah, it's a platonic relationship.
But
you're like,
though.
I get that you mean that in like the English vernacular way that is used. But it is not platonic unless you're co-authoring a book together. That was, I remember, my summary of... Dear listener, if you've ever been assigned to read Plato's Symposium and you would like the TLDR, it's this. Plato says, do you know what's better than sex? Co-authoring a book. That's what he says. He says, co-authoring a book is like having sex, but better. Because sex just produces children. Co-authoring a book produces a book!
Oh my gosh.
That's Plato's Symposium. See? Two colloquiums for one. Anyway, we were talking about video games.
She's right. And it's...
it's true!
It's very true.
He says other things, but that was the good bit. Anyway, did y'all have any questions for me in this kind of setup episode of my thesis?
What made you pursue this question other than the fact that you disagreed with someone?
Yeah, that's a good question, because it actually didn't start out with disagreement. The way this thesis started was I wanted to say, video games are unlike other forms of art. They've got these really unique features that make them worth studying. Video games can't be lumped together with everything else. They are a form of art, they are a form of fiction, they are a form of storytelling, but we can't just treat them like films because they happen to be on a computer screen. So I wanted to be able to say that, philosophically point out the differences and what makes video games special and how they have all these opportunities for really unique storytelling and really unique involvement and canon creation and cooperation and that kind of thing. And that we should look at them as unique entities in philosophy that are interesting and different. And so I was trying to detail what are some differences between games and films, and one of the biggest ones is that because the player has to involve themselves in the game, games can be vastly different every time that they're played, which is not true of films or most other forms of storytelling. In fact, I used to have a whole section in the essay and the thesis that had to be cut because it was just rambly, but I had a whole section that compared games to both choose-your-own-adventure novels and also Dungeons and Dragons.
Heck yeah.
I ended up just using the theater comparison because it was a lot more succinct, but those three things, tabletop games, video games, and choose-your-own-adventures, and to some extent theater, are some of the only forms of fiction that are variable in nature. And games have a couple other features. Games are referred to in the literature as self-involved interactive fictions. And so what I've just talked about is them being interactive. And that's what I'm going to talk about next time. In the third colloquium, we're going to talk about their being self-involved. So this colloquium, I mean, this thesis is divided into three parts. The first two go together. The third one is almost a completely separate essay that also has to do with what sets video games apart. And I'm really excited to get to that one because it's a fun
one. Awesome.
But,
I'm looking forward to it.
This time I compared video games to theater. Next time I'm largely going to be comparing them to serialized fiction.
So was it hard for you to find literature on this? Is this, like, a big field? Is it a growing field?
No, it's a pretty small one, which was actually nice because it means I didn't have, like, 3 years worth of reading to catch up on. Walton's was the main text that I read. And, I mean, Walton's book was only written in 1990. So that's extremely new by philosophy standards. And, I mean, honestly, one of the texts that I'm going to use next time that kind of saved me, I at one point hit this wall that it was like, oh no, I've reached a problem I don't have an answer for. And it turns out someone else had a really applicable answer. And that was literally written, like, a month before.
Phew.
Wow.
Yeah, it was written, like, in January, and at the time I was writing, it was like, February. And now, I didn't turn in the essay until, like, July, but still, it was written, like, 6 months before. I mean, some people have written explicitly on kind of the ontology of video games like I have, and people have written on the interaction between Walton and video games, so that was helpful. But mostly it's legit, like, the same three or four people have just written several things on it. So it was actually a rather confined literature space, which was good and bad. Bad because it was just less to work with, good because it was less to work with, and it gave me a lot more room to say, these are my ideas, which is something I really hadn't done a lot of. Even in my graduate work, I really shied on the historical side of kind of saying, Plato said things, and he was right.
Yay, Plato.
Whereas this was really me trying to say, no one's talking about this, so I'm just gonna talk, and you can't tell me I'm wrong, because no one else has said anything. I felt a lot of freedom also in that this made me the expert and not my assessors. No one in Oxford specializes in what I was writing in, which means that whoever graded my papers, I knew more than them on this topic, which was a really comfortable feeling. And it's anonymous. I have no clue who graded my stuff, but I mean, they liked it, so that's good.
You passed.
But yeah, it was, that's actually why I ended up dropping out of my ancient studies into general philosophy, was because I felt so burdened by the huge amount of literature present on people like Plato and Aristotle. It felt like if I was going to say anything at all on Aristotle, I would have to read everything ever written on Aristotle.
Which is impossible.
Including everything written by the professors teaching me, which was intimidating enough as it is. So I dropped out of general philosophy and ended up in a tiny little side pocket of philosophy that I basically had to make myself. Like I said, other people have written on this, but there's like maybe six of them. And a lot of those are on the ethics side.
I just have a great image of you, like, walking into an empty space in the jungle, and you're like, yep, this'll do. Pitching a little tent.
Yeah, well, it was kind of like walking into an empty space in the library and being like, this is mine now.
That shelf, I will fill it.
I don't think I'll fill it, but it's more kind of like walking along and coming to the edge of a cliff and just shouting words. And saying that no one can really respond to you.
I think there are two different instances of truth in video games.
Yeah. I felt so burdened by ancient philosophy that I just wanted to give up on philosophy completely. And everyone told me, write what you know, write what you like. And at the time, this was in when my depression was really kicking in really hard, and I was like, I don't like anything. I can't write about what I like because I don't like anything.
Oh, no.
But I found that even when I didn't like anything, I was still playing Mass Effect and Tomb Raider. And so I basically, to be honest, I don't want to say it started as a joke, but it almost started as a joke where I just said, how many times can I put the name Commander Shepard and Lara Croft into a paper and still get it passed through Oxford?
I'm going to talk about my postgrad problem now. My postgrad problem is that I am incapable of managing my time, apparently.
Wow. I mean, good that you know that about yourself, I guess?
Like, when I was in college, I was a part of so many clubs and organizations.
That's true.
We did so many things. We hung out, like, all the time.
You had so many friends.
I did! And, like, how did I have time for them all? I don't know. I must have. But now, I'm like, it's probably because I am no longer, like, puberty is solidly done. I have reached full adulthood and therefore do not have the same kind of energy as I used to.
I was gonna say, did you sleep in college?
Not a surprising amount for as involved as I was. But now, in addition to having much fewer hobbies and friends, I am somehow still having a hard time balancing what I want to do with my job and with friends and with hobbies and with sleep. And how do time management? Has it always been this way and I'm just now noticing it? Like,
Sorry, go ahead.
I'm so tired, man. I'm enjoying myself and getting things done, but I'm tired.
Here's a secret. Step number one, the only thing that I know about time management.
Okay. I'm ready.
You start saying no to people.
I do. I do all the time.
Oh, well then I can't help you.
Yeah, I don't say yes to everything like I used to. In fact, I told someone no this week. I ducked out of a volunteer opportunity because I knew I wasn't going to have time for it.
That's good. Yes. So, I mean, you got step one down.
All right, Cleo, well, we're all depending on you for step two.
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm still on step one.
Come fix it.
failed
step one.
No, I've passed step one. I just, like science, I can't seem to figure out, you know, I did all that, so why is it working? I will say, in fairness to our undergrad selves, I think, and I know it didn't feel like it at the time, so if you are listening to this and you are an undergrad and you're like, what do you mean I don't have anything going on? I understand that this is a time in your life where this is the busiest you've ever been. Embrace that. Okay? Because it's about
to
get...
It will not be the busiest you ever are.
It's about to get worse.
I mean, sorry. I will add, we all say that as people who, like, have done grad school and job things at the same time and have been in foreign countries while we've been doing grad school, and I've got a job that is essentially two jobs. And
also, you're in like six Dungeons and Dragons groups.
Listen, it's not like we meet weekly or anything.
Yeah, I
feel like I don't play more than two or three times in a really busy week. And even then, that's not as much time as you'd think. I'd spend equal amounts of time, like, laying in bed on Tumblr doing nothing.
Maybe that's your problem.
That I'm not laying in bed in Tumblr doing nothing?
That you are.
That you are laying in bed in Tumblr doing nothing. I mean, saying that makes me the biggest of all hypocrites, but it's a suggestion.
No, I actually haven't done that for a while.
That's good.
Like,
I actually had to take the Tumblr app off my phone for several reasons, but one of them was because I was just laying in bed on Tumblr for way too long, especially at, like, 1 in the morning.
Yep.
What I was saying about undergrad is that I think a big difference is a lot of those things that you did all took place in one confined area.
That's true.
There was no commute, that is true.
There was no commute. There was study and friends and clubs.
And a lot less having to spend time scheduling other things, if that makes sense.
What do you mean?
And everyone else was basically on a similar schedule, first of all.
Exactly.
Oh,
you didn't have to, like, shove, like, we can only do this right now because it's when everyone's free.
That's a fair point. That is a very good point. And I also knew that if I had to take a nap at 1 p.m. when I didn't have a class, I could do that because it wasn't like I was missing anything.
Yep.
Okay.
I think there's something real, though, about it's much more stressful when this is the only time we can all meet for the next 2 weeks, so it has to be right now. That just wasn't really there in undergrad.
Yeah. I kind of don't mind that, like, urgency of things. I don't know. Something that you said the other day struck me as, like, you need to have both structured and unstructured free time.
Yes.
Like, can you explain that some? Because I was thinking about that and realizing that most of what I had done last week was structured free time.
Yeah, I guess. It's just this idea that everyone has these certain things that they need. And everyone, I mean, you need all of them, but some people, like, to be mentally healthy, need more of them than others. And when I say mentally healthy, I don't mean, like, dealing with mental illness. I mean, just every day, everybody needs these things to just maintain their mental well-being. And there's lots of different things. Some of them might be like financial stability. For some people, being financially unstable, like not as stable as they could be, is kind of like, eh, I'll make it through. For some people, it's super duper stressful if you aren't as stable as you could possibly be. One thing that some people really need is structured time. Structured time is just what it sounds like. You have a plan, and you're doing it, and you're getting things done. And to say if you didn't have that, then you'd just be lounging around and would just start slowly getting more miserable because you weren't doing anything. I need structured time, but you can only tell after a really long period without it because everything starts going downhill. But there's also unstructured time. And unstructured time is a time when there are no demands on what you're doing. Not from anyone else, not from, I guess from a clock, but not from like any kind of strict clock. It's the kind of thing where you're off of work for the Saturday and you have no plans at all.
You just have a day.
And you can do whatever. You don't even have to go get groceries or whatever. You can just do whatever. And maybe what you want to do is go get groceries, but you don't have to.
I think it must be that I need both in any given day. Because if I spend a day doing either, I end up miserable. Like, only one or the other.
See, yeah, I can spend a very long time without structured time and be okay. Like, but when I say very long time, I mean, like, a week. But then it starts to show that, like, I'm getting very cabin sick. Even if I have a car and could leave, I still get cabin fever because I never choose to do so. Because no one is making the demand that I do, you know?
Yeah.
So I think everyone needs both. And you just have to figure out what your balance is. And you can find kind of creative times to get it. Like, so for some people, one of the things they need is time with other people. And, you know, you have to sometimes be creative because sometimes time with other people involves getting on Skype and making a podcast with them. and sometimes it means getting coffee with someone. Or alone time. Some people need that. And sometimes you have to get creative with that. I know a few people who really appreciate the fact that they have long commutes because they're alone during those commutes.
Yeah, I was gonna say I've experienced the same thing, and it is that feeling, for me, it's not just the feeling of, oh, someone canceled plans, it's a Saturday, I don't have to do anything. It's also, like for you, science, it might be more, oh, someone canceled plans, and now I can spend as much time as I want with people. For me, it's a Saturday, I have no plans, and everyone else in my house is not gonna be here. Yeah, and I've definitely had those moments where I woke up expecting everyone to be gone because they told me they were going to be gone and their plans got canceled. And then I was very grumpy about the fact that other people were in the house. I was just like, but why are you here?
Get out.
Go find somewhere else to be.
I don't know. I'm just tired.
I don't know if that helps with time management.
It does a little bit. I think, you know, mental weariness is a thing, and I think that that's more what I am experiencing than physical weariness.
Maybe what you need to do is just be more intentional about scheduling unstructured time. I know that sounds weird, scheduling unstructured, but, like, for instance, today, someone asked me, they were really only free on this weekend. We met last weekend, and they said, you know, do you want to meet again? Because everyone else is free, and I had to just say, I really need a day in. And I gave some reasons, like I've got some reading I have to do before tomorrow, and I've got this podcast I have to prepare for, but it was really just, I really need a day in.
Well, even when I was in Florida, people used to, a lot of the other interns would talk about, oh, are we going to go to the parks today? No, I'm not going to the park because no one can go with me. I would go to the theme park by myself all the time.
That sounds amazing, frankly.
It was amazing. Mm-hmm. I would especially go to Animal Kingdom and just walk the trails.
Yeah.
That's nice.
All day and look at the tigers and maybe ride a few rides by myself and watch all the shows. And it was just, I wouldn't really talk to anyone. I would just kind of, just me, bebopping through Disney World by myself. It was good. I actually the only way I survived 9 months working in the busiest theme park in the world was I had an entire day set aside where I do not talk to people. I would you know, barely leave my house on those days, and my roommates were at work, and so I wouldn't have to talk to them until they came home. I liked them, by the way. I enjoyed talking to them if they're listening to this. But it was just my day not to talk to people.
I'm basically doing that now. So because I get to choose my own schedule, I'm choosing to only work 4 days a week instead of five and taking Tuesdays off specifically to stay home. And like, in theory, this is to work on my thesis, which is I am doing. I'm trying to use that time productively. On Tuesdays, I go to the gym, do that kind of thing. But it's the exact same thing. I go to the gym, I put headphones on, I work out. I come home, I put headphones on, I work on my thesis. I don't have to interact with other people. But no, I felt a lot the same way when I traveled alone. Traveling alone is amazing.
It's so great.
But why it's amazing is because it's unstructured.
Yep.
Or, if you want it to be, it's structured. But it's whichever one you want. When I was in Florence, I didn't want to stand in line to go see Michelangelo's David, so I just didn't. And that didn't disappoint anybody. There wasn't anyone else there who was disappointed because we didn't get to see it, you know?
Yeah.
It's great.
My dream road trip is to just get in a car and go somewhere and stop at every weird billboard exit that just piques my interest. It's just like Battle of, I don't know, Bigfoot Creek or something, and you
I'm
go.
Not sure I could do a car ride alone. I would do a train, though.
I just want to do that. Every time I see, you know, come see the caverns of whatchamacallit, I'm like, I want to get off the exit, but I can't because I'm going somewhere right now.
And with other people who will object.
Yeah, nobody else wants to see the caverns of whatchamacallit. That's why they have a giant billboard there.
I suggest hostel hopping. You meet some fun people.
Yeah. I love hostels.
But I don't think a hostel is going to solve science's current problem.
No.
Hannah, are you still there?
What?
Okay, I thought we lost you.
I think I fell asleep.
Oh, no.
Oh, Lord, I think we should end this podcast on that bombshell. Good morning, science. We got off on a long tangent about
road
hostels and road trips. It's okay. It had okay. nothing to do with your time management problems.
Cool. So, what are we into this week?
Sleeping.
I could talk about my podcast.
do it.
Do you have a podcast?
I'm gonna. So.
You do? I hadn't heard.
Cleo and Rissa have been with me on this podcast venture, but I have written and am directing a fiction podcast called In Between. That's I-N-N Between. It is about what player characters in a D&D party do between sessions of a campaign, and it all takes place in the same inn. And it's very good. Even if I'm
it
saying
is very
so
good.
Myself, it's I did the casting today, which is Saturday. I should say I did the auditions today, and I think I have a cast, so that's exciting. And I'm just kind of, I guess I will say that I am into the concept of podcasts in general, because even a fiction podcast, which I will admit is it's a far cry, like, maintenance-wise from what we're doing here, it's still an extraordinarily low bar. Because I keep thinking about if I wanted to make this a film, all the things that I would have to do. And, I've been doing a lot of things, and that's part of the reason I'm having time management problems. But, like, it's still so easy. Because I just did it. Like, I just did that thing. So if you want to find us on Twitter, we're in between. I think we're in between with a underscore after the word between, because everything Why? Else was taken. But we're on there, and we've got a beautiful logo designed by our friend Gabrielle Buxman. I'm just real excited about everything in general.
It's very good.
That is exciting.
I really need to sleep because, like, oh my gosh, I was so excited this morning. I woke up at 5:45 and couldn't go back to sleep.
Woman, no.
Yeah, I know. It's, that's part of the this has been a big project, and on top of the work I'm doing on it, I'm very excited about it, which is not super good for sleep because I want to spend all night dreaming, daydreaming, night dreaming? Whatever. At any rate.
Make-believing.
It's going to be good.
It is going to be good. We've both done preliminary script reading.
They have mostly flattering things to say.
I demand to beta my favorite characters' voices, though. No.
We should end this podcast quick before I go to sleep.
Oh, the other thing I'm super duper into is the Olympics!
Yes!
Yay, Olympics!
Y'all, I somehow cannot bring myself to care about club sport, but the second a sport goes international, I suddenly care very deeply. And right now, the Olympics and the Rugby Six Nations is on, and I am living.
That is the most American thing I have ever heard you say.
Go sports!
If you buy your beloved a bouquet of bees for Valentine's Day, or you want to give Rissa your thoughts and opinions on the philosophy of video games, or you have some time management skills to impart to our poor sleep-deprived science,
please,
who just
guys.
Fell asleep live on this podcast, you can send us an
please
email.
Please do not just message and say, manage your time better.
Yeah.
That's not helpful.
I will fight you. Using my limited
she
time.
She will fight you, and she
I will
win.
Fight you.
You can email us at theliberalarts@gmail.com or find us on Facebook, Twitter, Tumblr, and now Instagram as The Liberal Arts.
Thanks for listening, and until next time, learn something worth knowing.
Done. Okay, now